You're listening to the Screaming Pods Network.
John?
Hang on.
What's up? My name is Dr. Ran, and I'm going to try and get you out of here.
After all my redecorating? No, I think I'll stay.
There's a guard with a pair of swollen testicles who swears you wanted out of here.
Oh, yeah. I changed my mind.
I see. The crosses are a nice touch. They'd almost have to keep you in here once they'd seen these, wouldn't they, John?
Got a smoke? You're waiting to hear about my them, aren't you?
Your what?
My them. Not every paranoid schizophrenic has one. A them, a they, an it. And you want to hear about my them, don't you?
I want to know how you got here.
Things are turning to shit out there, aren't they?
Let's talk about you.
Your dime. I was an insurance investigator, freelance.
Checked out phony claims, frauds, usual kind of thing. And lately I've been working for a firm here in the city. And all of this started with the disappearance.
The Sutter Kane.
It was a very tricky film to pull off. We did a lot of editing work on it because its impact needed to come in very strange places. We used a lot of flash frames and quick cutting and such to, I don't know, express anxiety and horror. It was the overall style of the whole thing that I had to struggle with, but that's the same with every movie.
Welcome to another episode of Just the Discs. My name's Brian Sauer. This is my podcast about Blu-rays. I have a returning guest in Miss Kaylin Corrigan. She was on previously the Curse of the Cat People episode, which I do recommend you go back and check out if for some reason you were like, oh, that's an old movie. I'm not going to listen to that one. You would be wrong, and you should listen to it. Anyway, thank you for coming back, Kaylin. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Okay, so we are talking John Carpenter this episode. There's a lot of John Carpenter activity on the Scream Factory front. I mean, there has been, but we just got a burst of releases, Memoirs of Invisible Man, which I did two weeks ago, and Someone's Watching Me, and then our topic of the day, which is In the Mouth of Madness.
Do you want to know the problem with places like this? With religion in general? It's never known how to convey the anatomy of horror. Religion seeks discipline through fear, yet doesn't understand the true nature of creation. No one's ever believed it enough to make it real. The same cannot be said of my work.
Your books aren't real.
But they've sold over 1 billion copies. I've been translated into 18 languages. More people believe in my work than believe in the Bible.
You got a point.
I think you know it.
There has to be some kind of an explanation for what I've seen tonight. Sort the shit out later, but right now there has to be some kind of a simple fucking explanation.
Always looking for the con. Even now you're trying to rationalize.
Anyway, your books suck.
This is the third chapter in Carpenter's, what he calls his Apocalypse Trilogy, which includes The Thing and Prince of Darkness, and then this movie. And I got to say, that is one hell of a really great group of films. I don't know how you feel about it, Kaylin.
I would definitely agree. Prince of Darkness is actually in my top three Carpenter, which
nice.
I know baffles most people.
I don't think that's baffling at all. It's a total wild card of a movie that I've come to appreciate more every time I watch it. And I could see it being, honestly, I could see it being somebody's favorite Carpenter. You know, it's just like, it's just different enough that I feel like there's something about it that makes it resonate. And yeah, like I said, every time I watch it, A, it creeps me the fuck out, and B, it just reveals itself to be a better and better movie. And the same thing happened on this rewatch of In the Mouth of Madness, which I'd already watched earlier this year, but this Blu-ray and then all the extras and stuff, I think, gave me another greater appreciation of the movie.
Totally. I didn't realize that it was the first time, I guess, that Greg Nicotero had worked with John Carpenter. And I think that's a big reason why the puppets look so amazing in this movie. And it holds up really well as a result of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, he has a great, I mean, we can talk about it a little more later, but we can touch on it now. Just interview with him where he talks about that early work, and I think that is definitely part of the reason that the movie is so memorable and so creepy. I mean, obviously the subject matter, it's based on, and I don't know which stories exactly, but I know that it's based on some Lovecraft stories, so you have a very heavy Lovecraft vibe, but it also feels like Clive Barker-y to me, maybe. I mean, I don't know if that's just my own projection, but like that sort of messed up metaphysical, like, monsters and nightmarish, I don't know what it is, but that there's something about it that reminded me a little bit of that, as well as the Lovecraft. I don't know if that's something that you feel at all, but it's just really memorable in that way.
Yeah, it's a real tumble down the rabbit hole. It's really cool to just watch Carpenter dig deep into the strange and the macabre, and the movie just gets weirder and weirder as it goes on. One thing that I know Carpenter touched on in his commentary on the Blu-ray, and I found as I was rewatching it that I really liked, is the way that they, the repetition in the movie, the way that they would show a character or a place, like the man who lost his son to Sutter Kane. And they kept going back to the bar that he was at, and each time they were there, the bar looked a little bit more distraught, and he looked a little bit more out of it, until in the end, he's completely falling apart, and the bar is in tatters, and then he eventually takes his own life. But
yeah,
just keep coming back to it over and over, and showing us how much worse everything is getting as time goes on.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a sense of, like, a very layered world, you know, that, like you say, tumbling down. You know, it just feels like it's descending into hell or something. I mean, because I was just noticing there's so many things that you do. I think one of the things I like is that they don't, well, I should just say briefly for those that don't know the story of the movie. I always forget to do that. I always want to go right into talking about it. But the basic story is that Sam Neill plays an insurance investigator who gets assigned to help this publishing company find their star author, this dude Sutter Kane.
You know, most of my salesmen couldn't sniff out a phony claim if their noses were nailed to it. But you, man, you never miss.
What's the miss? You learn to expect the worst in people and you get it. Everyone's looking to play an angle. I'm always there to clean up the mess.
I tell you what. You stop freelancing. Join my staff. I'll make it worth your while, Trent.
Forget it, Robbie. I'm my own man. Nobody pulls my strings. I'm independent. I'm happy.
Well, be my man one more time. I'm having quite a difficult mess with our king.
Publishing house?
Yeah, it's my biggest account. They just filed a claim. It cost me millions. I want you on this right away.
What's the claim?
Sutter Kane's missing.
Who?
Sutter Kane.
Do you read Sutter Kane?
What?
Who is like kind of a Stephen King-ish kind of dude, I guess.
Yeah.
And he's sort of gone missing, and so Charlton Heston, in a really great bit part, I just love Charlton Heston in movies, he sort of hires Sam Neill to go and find this guy, and he sends along somebody from the publishing company to go with him, but the whole time, Sam Neill's character is very dubious of everything. He's just like, this is just bullshit. This is some kind of publicity stunt. But there's a part of us that knows something is up because the movie starts in that very film noirish way, like even more elevated, because we see Sam Neill getting dragged into basically an asylum at the beginning, and he's like scrawled all over the walls of his padded cell. And then David Warner, who I always remember from Tron, comes in and talks to him, and basically he tells the story of how he got there. So it's one of those sort of like, I always feel like, I think of like Double Indemnity, I think of, there's a couple other This Is How I Got Here kind of film noir stories that it comes to mind. And I know that Carpenter had said he wanted him to be sort of like a Philip Marlowe kind of dude. But anyway, so that's the basic gist of the story. And he goes looking for the guy, and things kind of start to collapse onto themselves, and the reality just starts twisting and turning, and it's really, really powerful stuff.
Yeah, I like the interactions between Sam Neill's character and Linda when they go off to find Sutter Kane together, and she's such a big fan of his books, and she almost kind of believes in what he's writing. And John Trent, Sam Neill, is very adamantly like, that's not reality and it's just fiction and we're just here to do a job.
Stiles, can I ask you something? Do you really like working on Kane stuff?
You really like busting people?
Yeah. I bust frauds, I bust phonies, and yeah, I love it.
Have you ever busted anyone you know?
Yeah, sure I did. Didn't make any difference. See, in my business, you soon find out that anybody's capable of anything. If you can think of it, they've done it.
Doesn't leave you much to believe in.
Yeah, but think of the upside. At least it doesn't leave you too much to be disappointed in either. Believe me, the sooner we're off the planet, the better.
Now you sound like Kane.
No, not me. You're the Kane lover.
I just like being scared. Kane's work scares me.
What's to be scared about? It's not like it's real or anything.
Well, it's not real from your point of view, and right now reality shares your point of view. What scares me about Kane's work is what might happen if reality shared his point of view.
Whoa, we're not talking about reality here. We're talking about fiction. It's different, you know?
A reality is just what we tell each other it is. Sane and insane could easily switch places if the insane were to become the majority. You would find yourself locked in a padded cell, wondering what happened to the world.
No, and it wouldn't happen to me.
I would if you realized everything you ever knew was gone. I'd be pretty lonely being the last one left.
And it's very like Mulder-Scully relationship. And then it kind of starts to flip a little bit once they get there. And John Trent is saying that there's something wrong with this place. And then you see him slowly come apart. It almost feels like, I know the original ending, which this isn't what happens, so it's not a spoiler, but in the original ending, I guess the entire town gets sucked into the book.
Oh, wow.
Which I thought was really great. But I feel like the movie kind of feels that way. Like, it feels like you're slowly being sucked into one of Sutter Kane's books, and what you knew as reality is falling away, and you're just falling into this really strange, mystical universe that Sutter Kane has invented.
Yeah, absolutely. No, one of the things I was going to say that I like about it is once they show up in Hobbs End, which is the name of the town that Sutter Kane is supposed to be in, but it's sort of a fictional created town that becomes real. Once they're there, suddenly they find themselves kind of interacting with characters from his stories, and Sam Neill doesn't immediately know what's going on. Whereas Linda knows because she's read all the books, and obviously Sam Neill's read some in sort of preparation research, but he's not really thinking the way she is, which is when she's seeing all these things that are clearly in the books, she's starting to freak out. And he still thinks it's all some kind of a show, like they've hired actors to try and, you know, fool him. That's one of the things I like about the movie is that it's really the kind of story that's built around what Sam Neill can do really well, which is he can play like he plays like scientists. He plays people that definitely think of themselves as very intelligent and sort of above, kind of snooty kind of characters. But what I like about that is that they can easily have the rug pulled completely out from under them because they feel like they understand everything and they're one step ahead when in fact they're totally out of the loop. And So I think that helps for me to see his descent into insanity, that he starts from that place of like total skeptic, doesn't buy any of it, and then he's forced to confront the quote unquote reality of what is happening, and how that is just, it breaks him. It just absolutely, you know, makes him go mad. And I guess I just think that that is something Sam Neill can do really well for some reason. He's just got the ability to play it.
Yeah, for sure. And it's much easier to relate to his character initially, I think, than Linda's character, because she's already such a book groupie of Sutter Kane that you kind of think she's just going to believe whatever he throws at her. So you're more on Sam's side saying like, no, this is just a writer writing fiction and you got to go find him because he's gone off the deep end. And as his character slowly starts to believe what's happening, I think you buy it too. Whereas if they had both been kind of fans from the beginning, it wouldn't have been as easy to suspend belief.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, we're like with him, like we're kind of skeptical ourselves, you know, to a point. But then you start to see things that you can't explain. Great little touches like the painting in the hotel where they're staying keeps changing and gets more and more macabre and strange. And you see him noticing it and like touching the paint, kind of going like, how could they have changed this? And, you know, just like the old lady that works behind the counter gets like more and more. And I, you know what, I sort of drove, that didn't drive me crazy, but like made her even more disturbing to me, is that I know her as Adam Sandler's grandma from Happy Gilmore.
Me too.
Right? So like, I just kept thinking of her and like Ben Stiller giving her a hard time and how this character would have totally fucked up Ben Stiller in a big way. Anyway, but yeah, it's really neat the way the combination of really cool locations like this church.
Yeah, the church is great.
The Cathedral of the Transfiguration, Slovak Byzantine Rite Catholic Cathedral located in Ontario, is an incredible structure. I mean, it looks like quasi Taj Mahal-y architecture, but it's in the middle. I guess apparently it's not now, it's surrounded by condos in present day. Yeah. But in the movie and in the day that they shot it, it's not surrounded by anything, so it's by itself, and that alone is like so powerful, such an incredible image, right?
It's crazy because it looks like something that they built, but it's actually something that they found. But it looks just otherworldly enough to feel like something that was made for a movie, but it's actually apparently something that John Carpenter stumbled upon.
Yeah.
When he was being led to another church to look at.
See, that's the really cool thing about filmmaking and accidents, and you always hear that some of the best things that happen in movies are accidents, and that's clearly one of the best things that could have happened to them, because it really does help make Hobbs End this incredibly strange, dark, fantastic place. But then you combine that with the practical effects, makeup that they're doing in the movie, and how unsettling a lot of that stuff is in the sort of Lovecraftian vein. Like, you know, there's a shot of Sutter Kane when he's kind of like seducing Linda, I guess, and he's got like this dude like growing out the back of his head, and
yeah.
There's an amazing, and the main thing that Nicotero talks about in his little featurette is this like wall of monsters that is coming at them at one point, and all the different things that they did with that, and that whole parade float of craziness is just, I don't know. That kind of stuff just makes me, I mean, I think we're both probably practical effects people, and I feel like that there's a psychological thing, obviously, that you can connect to something that's real, and you can feel, I think you can feel when an actor is connecting to something that's real versus something that's not. I mean, good actors can make you believe anything, but I do think there's a subconscious level. Anyway, the combination of all those things really makes this like a living, breathing nightmare. And that's hard to shake, ultimately.
Yeah, I also love the little anecdote that because the guy was leading John Carpenter to go look at the church and he wanted the other one instead, that he got mad and left. And then Carpenter wound up hiring Cronenberg's crew to replace him.
Oh, that's awesome. I missed that. That's really cool. Let's see here. What some other things that stand out for me? Well, I was going to say, along the lines of that sort of nightmarish physical effects kind of reality the movie creates, and Sam Neill, I felt like, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't say it might be fun to watch this and Possession close together, although Possession always takes a lot out of me.
Would $800 a month for Bob be enough? I suppose.
Will you move in with him or keep the apartment?
I'll keep it if you allow me to.
I've decided not to see Bob.
At all?
At all.
How can you say that?
He's gonna be fucked up enough as it is, and I don't want to fuck him up even more by playing Sunday Daddy.
What were you to him anyway?
Precisely.
But he knows you. He's yours. He needs your...
A real father, full time? Well, I thought I could be coming home from the wars, so to speak. You say it's better with him than with me.
I get more out of it.
Tell me.
I think what you want to do to Bob is...
Inhuman? So what you're doing must be human. How long is it gonna last?
I don't know.
1 week, 2 weeks? And how do you dispose of ideas like honesty and loyalty? If I could only believe that it happened cleanly at first sight.
Okay. If it makes things easier. I was in his bed the first night I met him, if you have to know.
What do you expect of me? Look what you're doing!
No one is good or bad, but if you want, I'm that one. And if I knew he existed in this world, I would have never had Bob with you!
Get out! Get out! Get out!
But, you know, just because they have him and in a sort of a similar descent into madness, there's a little bit, there's a lot more emotional heft to Possession than there is to In the Mouth. But anyway, just I couldn't help but think of that movie when I was watching this, too.
It does kind of share that interspecies relationship, I guess you could say.
Yes, exactly. No, you're right.
Yeah, they both kind of have the man losing the woman to the creature.
You're totally right. See, that's a good, I didn't even thought of that. It's subconsciously in there, but I hadn't thought of it. Some other things I like the music. It's Carpenter and this guy James Lang, and I guess they had worked together on Body Bags. So it's got the Carpenter guitar feel to it, but it almost feels like Megadeth or Metallica or something. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
But I dig it.
Yeah, it feels very Maximum Overdrive to me.
Absolutely. I have a soft spot for that.
I worked with a new collaborator on The Mouth of Madness. Actually, I'd worked with him one time before on a TV thing I did, Jim Lang. And he brought a lot of musical ability. I'm more of a improvisational composer. In other words, I improvise to the image. Jim's approach was more planned out, and he did a great job. He laid down tracks for, I don't know whether it was 40%, 50%, maybe more of the movie while I was away. Then I came in and joined him, and we redid some and added this and that. And it was a really terrific collaboration. It's very different than my other scores. I was always influenced by Jerry Fielding. I think he's one of the great composers. His scores for Peckinpah's movie, Wild Bunch and Straw Dogs, were just amazing. And we talked about that ahead of time. I don't think we got anywhere near him, but he's one of my heroes.
What are some other things that stand out to you, like, as memorable from this film?
Well, you know, you touched on this a little bit earlier, but I also noticed the very film noir vibes going on. And I feel like, you know, it's just an example of how, even though Carpenter is making horror movies, in a way he's not making horror movies. And maybe that's something that draws me to him personally.
Absolutely.
Because we've talked about this a little bit before, but like how Assault on Precinct 13 is very Rio Bravo. And Carpenter has said that he's a big fan of Westerns. So I don't think that's unintentional.
Absolutely not.
And basically, this is a exploitation action picture modeled after Rio Bravo, which is one of my favorite Westerns with John Wayne, Ricky Nelson, Dean Martin. That was directed by Howard Hawks, basically men trapped in a jail against forces of evil outside. I just took the basic premise and reworked it for modern day Los Angeles. The film editor is John T. Chance on this film, And John T. Chance is John Wayne's character in Rio Bravo, Sheriff Chance. So that was my offhanded way of saying this was a kind of an homage to Rio Bravo, although in many ways it resembles Night of the Living Dead, strangely enough.
And you mentioned Double Indemnity, and I thought that too, especially with John Trent's job. It's very Walter Neff in Double Indemnity. I think it might actually be the same exact job.
Yeah, no, he's an insurance investigator, and I feel like there's a similar scene early on in Double Indemnity where he and Edward G. Robinson are basically busting somebody on some kind of scam they're pulling off.
Yeah. Now look, Arlopez. Every month, hundreds of claims come to this desk. Some of them are phonies, and I know which ones. How do I know? Because my little man tells me.
What little man?
The little man in here. Every time one of these phonies comes along, he ties knots in my stomach. I can't eat. Yours was one of them, Garlopas. That's how I knew your claim was crooked. So what did I do? I sent a tow car over to your garage this afternoon. And they jacked up that burned-out truck of yours. And what did they find? They found what was left of a neat pile of shavings.
What shavings?
The ones you soak with kerosene and drop the match on.
Look, mister, I'm just a poor guy. Maybe I made a mistake.
That's one way of putting it.
I ain't feeling so good, Mr. Keyes.
Just a minute. Sign this and you'll feel fine.
Sign what?
It's a waiver on your claim. Right here.
Here?
Here. Now you're an honest man again. Goodbye, Garlopas.
Well, I ain't got no more truck. $2,600 is a lot of dough where I live.
Smarter, Garlopas. Don't you know how to open the door? Just put your hand on the knob. Turn it to the left. Now pull it towards you. That's the bar.
And they have a similar scene, really fun scene, with Carpenter regular Peter Jason at the beginning of this movie. So yeah, that's another thing that I definitely thought of, was the whole insurance investigator angle. And I guess I won't ever think of insurance investigators without thinking of Double Indemnity. I think that's just forever implanted in my head.
Definitely, me too. That's one of my favorite movies.
Nice.
But yeah, that scene is almost beat for beat the same. And you know, in The Mouth of Madness, like they're in the office with the Venetian blinds, and it's just like very film noir. And I know that Carpenter said that he was telling Sam Neill to touch his ear.
Oh, yeah.
Like Humphrey Bogart does in Big Sleep.
Yeah.
And it's like he's always going for that Raymond Chandler look to his movies. And yeah, I think if Rio Bravo is his Western, then In the Mouth of Madness might in a way kind of be his film noir.
Yeah.
It's like a film noir meshed up with the Lovecraft Twilight Zone vibes.
Totally. Yeah, no, that's really cool. I think you're totally hitting on something that makes a lot of sense about him sort of smuggling, I guess, or, you know, making one movie inside of another movie, you know, making Westerns. Like Vampires is pretty much a straight Western almost. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like he almost isn't hiding it at all. But yeah, I mean, I feel like Western iconography and Western plot and character types are all over his movies, and I think that does give them something special that I think some other horror filmmakers don't have going on. I mean, he's obviously just an incredible filmmaker, like a born, made-to-make-movies guy. That's what he should be doing, you know? So there's that, too. But I do like the idea that he's cine-literate, and he's always bringing other things into and under these stories he's telling.
Yeah, because Julie Carmen, yeah, she's definitely like channeling Lauren Bacall.
Oh, yeah.
This.
Yeah.
And I think Carpenter even told her to watch His Girl Friday.
Yes, yes.
So there's definite film noir stuff going on. And I think, you know, there's a lot of talk lately about elevated horror as if this is something that just happened. But I feel like if you look back, like the reason why we love Carpenter so much is because even movies like this, which some people may glance at and pass off as silly because they've got these monsters and these creatures, but they're really well-made movies from an experienced filmmaker who clearly has a passion for all genres.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I have to admit that I was one who had given this one a little bit short shrift, and in rewatching it for the other show this year and then again for this, I think it's one of his better films. Like it's definitely maybe his, I don't want to say, I hate saying things like his last great movie, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, cause I really feel like there's always something interesting in everything he does, but as a whole complete vision, I think it's one of the last great things that he did. And that's not to say that he's not capable of doing that again. I would love to see another movie from him. He hasn't made one in a long time, so I hope he does. But yeah, I was just like, I don't know why. I think maybe there was something about the idea of this book coming to life, and I had seen Wes Craven's New Nightmare relatively around the time. I think that came out after this. But I think I was like, oh, it's probably just like that. And I think I didn't even see it for a while. So there was just a really stupid impulse in me to not give this the proper due, you know?
Yeah, I think this movie and Vampires and Village of the Damned kind of get brushed off even by horror fans, even by quote-unquote diehard Carpenter fans. But they each have something special about them.
Yeah.
Like you were saying, there's still a Carpenter touch in there, even if the final product isn't quite the level that we're expecting. Because we are expecting a higher level of filmmaking from him.
Yeah, that's the unfortunate side of being great at what you do. And having made, ostensibly for me, my favorite movie of all time, which is The Thing. So once you do that, you set the bar pretty high. And I feel bad for the guy on some level. It's like he's sort of cheating himself a little bit because he can't, he's not going to hit it. Like, he's not going to make The Thing every time out, you know? But
yeah, and The Thing's actually almost a little off base for him because he's such a cute old man. And he's so about like not showing blood and gore. You know, he even said in the commentary for In the Mouth of Madness, the scene where the man that loses his son kills himself, he's like, see, and we don't need to show that. All you need to see is the hand. We don't need to get gory here. It's like such an old man thing to say. He's so adorable.
I think that is adorable. And I do sometimes also wonder if it isn't, I sometimes think about him as he's just like a no-nonsense guy. So like the idea of like, taking the time and energy to create prosthetics and whatever you would need to like show all that gore. I think there's also a part of him that's just like, why would we waste that time and energy? We don't need to show it. We don't need to do it, you know? And that's just that's the other thing I love about him. He's very pragmatic. He's very practical in, you know, what you need to see and what you don't and what the film needs and what it doesn't. And I think that's really essential to a great filmmaker.
Yeah, he was saying in the commentary that he thinks that his dialogue scenes don't get enough credit because he's talking about every time you move the camera, then it messes up the light and you have to rearrange it. And he's like, I'm very good at getting in there and being efficient and getting what you need and getting out.
No, it's true. I don't think his dialogue does get enough credit. And for a guy who loves Howard Hawks,
yeah,
and a lot of Hawks' films are all about dialogue and character. And
how long is it since we've seen each other?
Oh, well, let's see. I spent 6 weeks in Reno, then Bermuda, about 4 months, I guess. Seems like yesterday to me.
Maybe it was yesterday, Hildy. Been seeing me in your dreams?
Oh, no, Mama doesn't dream about you anymore, Wally. You wouldn't know the old girl now.
Yes, I would. I'd know you anytime, any place.
Anywhere. You're repeating yourself, Walter. That's the speech you made the night you proposed.
Yeah, I noticed you still remember it.
Of course I remember it. If I didn't remember it, I wouldn't have divorced you.
Yes, I wish you hadn't done that, Hildy.
Done what?
Divorce me. Makes a fella lose all faith in himself. Almost gives him a feeling he wasn't wanted.
Oh, now, look, Junior, that's what divorces are for.
Nonsense. You've got an old-fashioned idea. Divorce is something that lasts forever, till death do us part. Why, divorce doesn't mean anything nowadays, Hildy. Just a few words mumbled over you by a judge. We've got something between us nothing can change.
Well, I suppose you're right in a way, Walt.
Sure, I'm right.
I am fond of you, you know.
Hello, girl.
I often wish you weren't such a stinker.
I think if you watch enough Hawks, you can definitely see that he's going for it. He's trying to do that, you know. The Thing is definitely that. I mean, obviously, that's based on a movie that Hawks more or less directed and whatever. But yeah, no, I think it's interesting, especially this far on, like what he's remembered for. And I don't think if you ask any 10 horror fans what they like about his movies, they'd be like, oh, the dialogue is my favorite thing. But it is really good. Like, there's a lot of them that when I think about it, it's as strong as any horror movie I've ever seen, you know, in terms of, but I think that comes from rooting the movie in character. And he's really interested in that, you know, going way back to his influences, as it were.
Yeah, I feel like he's also kind of a master at endings.
Oh.
Like, maybe not every single time, but there are so many memorable endings to his movies that I can think of. Like, one of the best parts of In the Mouth of Madness is the end.
Yes.
Like, it's so great to watch Sam Neill laughing in that theater, and how many people have been inspired to create Halloween costumes because of that moment alone.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Yeah, no, you're right. That is, I mean, it's kind of old hat to say it even, but endings are probably the hardest thing to do in movies. And I think as I've gotten older and I've seen more movies, I've become, I think, a little bit more forgiving of endings, because I know it's got to be really hard to just close things up. It's so much easier to start out really strong, you know, and I think that there's a skill to that. But to close things up and to bring this whole story to a close, that can't be easy. I can't imagine, like, if I was a filmmaker, I think that would be the part that I would just belabor for just ever, just years, you know?
Yeah, and I love his Prince of Darkness ending, and I feel like it's very Inception. Like,
oh, yeah?
I even wonder if Inception was partially inspired by the ending of that, because it ends right when his fingers are about to hit the mirror, and you're not sure if he's going to be sucked into this other dimension or if it's just a dream.
Oh, yeah. I would bet. I can't imagine Nolan's not a giant John Carpenter fan. I just can't imagine he's not. I feel like any good filmmaker has to be a John Carpenter fan.
Yeah. Certainly wouldn't trust any filmmaker that's not a Carpenter fan.
I couldn't agree more with that. Let's talk a little bit about, you already sort of touched on it a little bit. We can talk about the extras. We've got, this is the new, another thing I never do at the beginning of my episodes is say, well, we're talking about the new screen. Well, we talked about Scream Factory, but we're talking about the Scream Factory Blu-ray of In the Mouth, and it's got a whole bunch of extra features. It's got a new commentary track with he and his wife, which I thought was a lot of fun. I thought it was great to just kind of hang out with them and listen as they, it's a little sparse in spots, but I'm like, well, this feels like sitting with a married couple watching something they worked on, which is the perfect experience for me. My favorite thing that I think I heard in there was the His Girl Friday bit, which I think he mentions in both commentaries, but there's some point where they had to do some kind of montage, and Carpenter says, I remember Bob Shea telling me that this montage was cliche, and Sandy's like, Bob Shea is cliche. I was like, that's awesome, and I'm glad they left it in.
She clearly was not a fan of his.
Yes, that was definitely not even hinted at, which was great. I like their rapport. I mean, she's obviously an incredible part of his filmmaking, and they just have this really great energy together. I don't know. I loved it.
They're really cute together. I love the scene where Sam goes in the hotel room and is trying to find Linda, and she's in the bathroom, and he sees the tentacles coming out from underneath the bathroom door.
Yeah.
And then they get sucked back, and she walks through the door all smiley. And Sandy is like, no, don't. No, it's not right. And she walks through the door smiling, and John's like, she's fine. She's good.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. So that's a new track exclusive to this Blu-ray. Then there is another commentary with him and his DP, Gary Kibbe. This one is much more technical, and I think it's really also kind of sweet of Carpenter, because I feel like he wants to involve Gary in the commentary. So he's just like, Gary, do you remember how you lit this scene? And Gary seems like he seems also like a very no-nonsense, sort of serious, but obviously, you know, good to work with kind of cinematographer. But it was interesting to listen to that one and hear surprisingly how much Gary could remember about specific scenes and lighting them and the challenges of lighting them. And Carpenter also makes him sort of like back up and put things in layman's terms, in terms of like, you know, like what's a neutral density filter, or, you know, all this other sort of mumbo jumbo that, I mean, maybe some people would find it boring, but I don't know. I'm fascinated by the whole process, so I was amused by it.
Same here. I actually was thinking, if I ever go film something, I will go back and listen to that commentary again, because there's so much good information there. If you want to know what lenses they used, how much light they used, how they shot, like every single scene in that movie, you will find out in that commentary. It's very informative.
Absolutely. And it feels like there's a lot of scenes where they're mixing inside and outside light, which I would think would be something people making films on a budget would be dealing with, probably. And
we're shooting out into the street,
And as my experience, it's really difficult to light a scene like this where you're looking out into daylight and you are in the inside and you've got two actors in the foreground. Lighting them to make them look like they match the outside, is that hard to do?
You just have to have enough light power to light the individuals to balance with the amount of sunlight that is happening outside from the sun naturally. And generally, in this case, we're shooting through a window that we didn't have the opportunity of gelling with a filter, which knocks down the outside light to a level that is more favorable for balancing and not using as many lights inside to achieve a balance where you can see the background and the interior at the same time, which you would see normally if you were in that same situation.
Well, you use the word balance a lot, Gary. What do you mean by that? I don't know if the listeners will understand. Sam and Bernie in the foreground are lit, and in the background is slightly brighter. You're talking about the balance between the light between the two situations, is that right?
Right. The light inside, the amount of light inside and the amount of light outside. Now, if one of the outside or the inside is much brighter than the other, many times it'll be real light and washed out look, and you won't really see any color or detail. So what you have to do is pretty much build the interior up to a level that it's acceptable, so you will see what's happening outside.
So there's a lot of really great advice on that level that it would never occur to me. I mean, I know enough about filmmaking, but not, I'm kind of like Carpenter in this, like he's basically like, this is why I have this guy, because he knows the lenses, I think. But beyond that, he's just like, yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. Which is kind of like, okay, yeah, sure.
I know. I love that he even admits that. And there's even like a point in that commentary where he says, oh, see, yeah, this is why I didn't go into that field of study. It's much easier to be a director.
That's right. Yeah, no. So they have a good rapport, and he worked with him a bunch. I feel like, I don't know where he started with him. I feel like he was on Prince of Darkness, but I could be wrong. Now I gotta look it up.
It looks like Gary Kibbe worked on They Live and Body Bags before In the Mouth of Madness.
Okay, so he didn't do Prince of Darkness with him.
Oh,
okay.
Actually, you're right. He did do Prince of Darkness as well.
Great.
So I guess Prince of Darkness is the first time they worked together in 1987, and then they continued working together through Escape from L.A. and Vampires.
Nice. Yeah, see, that's great. It's a good chunk of movies. But yeah, he obviously, whatever they were doing together worked because he stuck with him for a while. Obviously, he used Dean Cundey for a while, and Dean Cundey's like one of my favorite cinematographers of all time. But it says something to me that Carpenter ended up taking up with Gary Kibbe after that, because he must be good at what he does. Those movies look great. So that was a fun track.
Yeah, it's always refreshing when somebody can be so humble that they're known as a master of horror, and they sit there and tell you that the guy next to them is doing a tougher job.
Yeah, he definitely is not like, again, no nonsense about like filmmaking is a collaborative thing, you know, that he didn't come up with every great idea in the movie. He's not trying to take credit for every great idea. And, you know, he's just like, I just know how to make the movie and I get a lot of help. And, you know, it's almost like he doesn't even think the movies are good or something. He's just like, yeah, it's just this thing that I did, whatever.
Yeah, he's notorious for not liking watching his older movies because he says that all he sees are the mistakes.
Yeah, I mean, I get that as a filmmaker, I'm sure that that's got to be difficult, and I would probably have the same issues, but the man's made some good movies. So also on this disc, we have an interview with Julie Carmen called Whisper of the Dark, which is about 10 minutes.
I was more used to campier horror films, but all I remember is that when I walked on the sets, there was nothing sitcom about it. It was dark. It was, you really felt that you were inside the recesses of a nightmare. I was there when the monsters were coming down the hallway, and that's where I really got to watch John in his milieu of making monsters happen. It was like watching a master marionetteer, a puppeteer, just moving all of the elements. So I learned a lot about how John does what he does.
Yeah, she did mention the His Girl Friday thing you talked about, that she should watch that specifically for the Rosalind Russell character as sort of an influence on her character in this movie. And she said part of her interest in the material was that she is also a psychotherapist, I guess. And so there was something about that field of study that made her want to deal with this stuff. Yeah, so I don't know. I think Julie Carmen, I had forgotten some of the other movies that she's in. She's in Fright Night Part 2, and she's in Gloria, which is a John Cassavetes movie. Like, basically, I was just sort of, she was talking about some of the other films that she did, and I just saw an actor who had made some really interesting choices. And I always think that is pretty cool, because I know it's got to be difficult to be an actor at all, and to try to shape your career in any specific way must be nigh unto impossible, because it's just like you got to take the next gig. But to do us just be like, I want to do this movie and this movie and this movie, I just have a lot of respect for that, you know. And she definitely seems to have had an interesting run that I just had totally forgotten about.
Yeah, for sure.
And then you've got the Greg Nicotero interview. That's about 16 minutes. Like I said, he talks about the Wall of Monsters. Do you remember anything else he touched on in that one?
Yeah. I guess he said it was his first big movie that he did with John Carpenter. He might have done a little bit of work on Body Bags before that.
Okay.
But this is the first time that he was brought on. Him and KMB did all of the effects, and they look incredible. And he was talking about that one puppet in particular that you mentioned earlier that sits on the back of Sutter Kane, and how they were just trying to create the merging of realities and go for a kind of Total Recall look.
Oh, yeah.
And once he said that, I was like, oh, yeah, that is very Total Recall. Okay.
Yeah, I missed that. Yeah, that definitely makes sense. Yeah, it's just a really gnarly group of physical effects that they did for the movie. One effect that I don't know if he touched on, it's near that scene, but I don't think it's anything that they had to do. But the one image that stands out to me that I wanted to mention previously is there's a shot of a giant book page as it's ripped open, and on the other side is the monsters. But there's something really unsettling about this giant book, and the page is tearing out and going through one side and coming out the other. I don't know. It just really stuck out to me. Sam Neill, the look on his face as he's going through the book page, I guess I'll never forget that either. But
yeah, I also love the scene where Sam is trying to grab Linda and get out of town, and he's realizing along the drive after she swallows the keys that maybe she's not in her right mind. And they pull over, and she gets out of the car and like gets on all fours, and her body twists around, and she becomes this weird crab-like monster.
Exorcist level, yeah.
Yeah, it's actually like a contortionist with a practical mask put on, but it looks creepy as hell. And I actually, my friend Evan is going to be directing this new season of Channel Zero, and he showed me an image from the upcoming season, and there was something that looked very similar to that. So obviously it still creeps people out.
Nice. Yeah, no, that's a great, I mean, there's so many images that, I'm going to digress for a second, that stand out outside of the monster effects. The old guy on the bike is one of my favorite things in the whole movie. And just the way that he appears, first like riding away from them, and you're just like, what the hell is that? And then suddenly he comes back, and you see what he looks like, and then they hit him with the car, and then he has the voice like almost of a child, which is even more unsettling. But yeah, there's something about creepy dudes in old makeup riding bikes in the dark that definitely creeps me the fuck out.
Yeah, and that's another one of those scenes. I mean, it's shorter, but that's another one of those scenes where you see the same image being shown over over, and it just gets stranger each time we see it.
Yeah, there's like three times,
Yeah, because you see that kid in the beginning riding his bike, and he's a normal kid, and then he rides by again, and he's a little bit older, and he just gets older and older each time that he rides by. But I thought that... Yeah, so another thing that's interesting about that Paperboy is it's actually Hayden Christensen, who went on to play Anakin Skywalker in Star Wars.
Wow. I had no idea. I did not catch that at all. That's bizarre.
Yeah, isn't that shit. Nuts?
That's crazy.
A better performance than Star Wars.
Maybe his best.
Best to date.
I mean, Shattered Glass is a decent movie, but I think I got to give it to him on this. Sorry, I'm getting all sidetracked here.
Paperboy.
Let's see. I think that's almost all the features. There's Horrors Hallowed Grounds, a short episode of that show with host Sean Clark, who goes to a bunch of the locations in, I think, Toronto. A bunch of them. The publishing office. He goes to this really cool covered bridge that they use to to be the entrance to Hobbs End. They go to the asylum, the exterior, which is like a water treatment plant or something. And he goes to the movie theater that Sam Neill goes to at the end of the movie. I love that stuff. I don't know about you, but it's one of those things where I'm always reminded, like, I should really do a pilgrimage to Pasadena or whatever, just go to some Halloween locations. I just never do it. And when I see shows like that, I'm reminded I really want to do it.
You should. I have definitely made it a annual tradition for myself to go visit the Halloween house every year.
Nice.
Which I'm sure will be probably more popular now that the new Halloween movie is coming out.
It's going to be a madhouse.
A madhouse. there's lots of locations in LA.
Oh, yeah. I mean, since it's so close to the studios, just tons and tons of stuff has been filmed around here. So I don't know. I really like just the idea of showing a scene from a movie and showing it now and how things have changed. And I don't know. There's just something really not melancholy, but I don't know, wistful about the way that time marches on and that these movies that we hold dear, that we would almost want to memorialize. It's just like, you know, whoever owns that property is just like, yeah, we got a business to run. Who gives a shit about your movie? We gotta move on. We gotta rent this space out. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't mean anything to them. And I get it. That's not, but for us, these spaces are sacred, you know?
It's also interesting to see how much effort goes in production wise to, even if they don't build the building that they're filming in, to tweak it, to make it work in that world. Like the church that they go to, although the church was already there, apparently, I guess, like Sean Clark was saying in that featurette, they redid the doors for the movie because he was like, the doors are completely different on the outside than they are in the film. In the film, they're very gothic and tall, but in the real life version, they're just like regular old rustic, not even rustic, metal doors.
Really boring doors.
Yeah, he's like, I don't imagine that they would have changed the doors after that movie, so they probably changed the doors for the movie.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. You know, it doesn't make sense that they would, because the doors in the movie are amazing. You would, anyway.
Yeah.
I just think that stuff is always interesting, too, yeah. But I don't know. So that's the special features side of things.
I liked the vintage making of
feature. Oh, yes, my bad.
I thought that was a... Oh no! I just thought it was cool because it's very cute because they show you they're like, you know, the guy that brought you the thing and Halloween, they're like, it's 1995, this is John Carpenter. Just like very intense way of introducing this movie, and it spoke to the old man in me.
Yeah, no, I do like period marketing stuff like that, you know, because it's taking wherever that filmmaker is at that time and, like you say, just sort of talking them up from that point of view. Obviously, we know that he's done a lot more since then, and maybe we would emphasize different things even in 1994, but I always find it interesting what the marketing departments decide to emphasize in those little sort of, a lot of times they're a little bit like fluffy, sort of puffy featurettes, but I still love to see them. And I actually kind of like to see John Carpenter in them because, again, that sort of no-nonsense side of him, it's just like, you can feel that, like, at the edge of where they're cutting away from him, that he's just like, all right, you got enough? Are we done? You know, like,
yeah.
But he is, you know, professional about his responses and is able to muster some passion about what he's trying to do with any particular film he's being interviewed about. But I do think... because I was just watching the special features on the Memoirs of Invisible Man, and there is a point where he actually is like being interviewed and he's like, do you have what you need? He's like, I gotta go back to work, you know. And so now I always think of him at the end of like a little interview that he's just like ready to be done talking about it, you know.
Yeah, I'm almost a little surprised that he has social media because he just seems to be a man that would not entertain that for a second.
No, and there was I had my geek moment with him. I want to say I took my son to the, was it the 25th anniversary? I think it was the 25th anniversary screening of Big Trouble in Little China. And he did a Q&A after. And the one question that at the time I wanted to know the answer to, because it wasn't clear at the time. He wasn't verified on Twitter. And so I was just like, is that you? And he was like, yeah, that's me. You know, like you never know. And you never know also if it's somebody else doing it or whatever. But that was my one question that I wasted on him, was just like, is that really you doing that Twitter? Because like you, I was like, I don't believe that he's into that. And
yeah.
So I think it's pretty adorable that he does.
This is a man who makes movies about monsters while referencing Howard Hawks. It's not exactly the type of guy you would think would have a Twitter. I also, yeah, I love that Charlton Heston was in this movie. Just a side note.
Yeah, definitely.
I love John Carpenter talking about how cranky he was. It was really amusing.
Look, do you think those books somehow infected you?
Listen to me, Harklow. Everything I've said is true. It's real. And that's why I had to destroy the last manuscript, you know.
But I know that's not true.
What are you talking about?
You delivered that manuscript to me months ago. To me personally, in this room.
Did?
Yes, you did. Last spring. For God's sakes, we published in July. The book's been in the stores for 7 weeks.
Have you read it?
No, I never read Kane's work. I haven't got the stomach for it.
Pull it, don't distribute it. Look, even if everything I've said is totally Looney Tunes, I know this book will drive people crazy.
Well, let's hope so. The movie comes out next month.
Yeah, no, he's great. I mean, like, politics aside, as an actor, I find him pretty remarkably entertaining. He's just like, he personifies larger-than-life personality. Just the way that he sits, the way that he speaks, the way that he pauses. There's just something about the way that he does everything that I just find, I don't know, incredibly amusing also.
Yeah, I think John Carpenter definitely feels the same way about John Wayne. Like, I guess he totally used to have a bumper sticker of John Wayne on his car, and it would make his friends mad because they're like, how can you support someone like that? And he was like, well, not only is it not about the politics, I respect him as an actor and I'm a huge fan of Westerns, but he's like, I just love to piss off my friends.
That also seems like something he would do. He's very sort of like, stick it to whoever, the man typically, but like, fuck you.
Fuck you, pay me.
Yeah, exactly. He's great that way. And I think that's another thing, that sort of irreverent spirit comes through in the filmmaking. And I think that's part of the reason I love him, honestly. But I don't know. Is there anything else that you didn't get to that we didn't touch on as far as this movie goes?
Aside from, yeah, my amusement over Sandy Keane just being very blatantly not a fan of Bob Shea. That was really an enjoyment for me.
Yeah, because I do feel like even after that, it came up again. Like, there was something else where she said something.
Yeah, there was a few times. Because, yeah, he said that the montage... Oh, there was one thing. Yes, okay. One thing when I was listening to the commentary that I heard Carpenter say, and I was like, oh my God, I got to make sure to mention that. He was talking about the scene in the beginning when Sam Neill is in his padded cell and the world is falling apart outside and he's got the crosses drawn all over the walls. And he just kind of sees through his window shadows of monsters taking over people and he hears screams. And John Carpenter says in the commentary, you know, whenever you've got a low budget, not much to work with, you just play with shadows and sounds. And then he says, but of course, the king of shadows and sounds is Val Lewton.
That's right. That's right. I can't remember if I wrote that down, but I definitely noticed it. And yeah, that was great. That was great. Not surprisingly, he's a fan, you know? The dude knows his movies. I just think that's awesome.
I know.
The last thing we talked about was Val Lewton.
Yeah. We talked about Curse the Cat People. And I was like, yep, see, Val Lewton has influenced absolutely everybody.
Everybody that's good knows him.
Everybody that's good.
Very cool. Well, if you don't have anything else... Or maybe you do.
I am curious about what your top three Carpenter films are, if you don't mind saying that on air.
Okay, let me think about it. You go ahead first while I think about mine.
Well,
you've already done a list of them.
I did.
And does that list stand, by the way? Is that still the...
I feel like I definitely am such a huge fan of his that sometimes movies will shift around for me because, like, when I'm watching Assault on Precinct 13, I'm like, this is the best movie he's ever made, period.
And I love that you love that movie. I think that's a fantastic movie.
It's so well made. I feel like it's totally underappreciated.
I agree.
It's so incredibly tense. I think, without a doubt, it has his best score. I know that Halloween is his most popular score, and The Thing is great, but yeah, nothing beats Assault on Precinct 13.
No, the best.
But my top three, yeah, are Halloween, The Thing, and Prince of Darkness.
Nice. Damn it. Now, you know, mine could change from time to time, but I think for me, it would probably be The Thing, Big Trouble in Little China, and then probably Halloween, although Assault would almost be in my top three. Like, I really love that movie. I feel like it's blasphemous to put it above Halloween, though. You know, like, there's just something doesn't feel right about that. But I agree that it's totally underrated, and it would probably be a close fourth spot for me. But, I mean, I love so many of his movies. Like, it's just like cutting off fingers to think about, like, trying to only name three favorites. But yeah, I think those are my top. I think those are my favorites.
Yeah, I think I personally like it best when Carpenter is going for a darker style and more contained in the horror genre, because I love Big Trouble in Little China, but I think I'm more drawn to him when he's straightforward horror and trying to get under your skin.
I totally get it. I think that I'm a Kurt Russell fanboy for life.
Yeah.
I was lucky enough to go to, a friend of mine got an invite to an event just like a couple weeks ago that was for Wild, Wild Country, the documentary series.
Oh, yeah, I heard that's terrific.
Yeah, it's really good. But it was those filmmakers who I guess had worked on the documentary about Kurt Russell's dad, the baseball documentary. So Kurt was, I don't know if he was an executive producer, but it was like a very small event and he was there and I lost my fucking mind. I couldn't like say anything to him. He was kind of like blocked off, but I was like very close to where he was at with Goldie Hawn and I was just losing my shit. I think that's part of my thing. Why Big Trouble is in my top two is I just think he's literally, along with like Jeff Bridges and like Robert Mitchum, I think Kurt Russell is like one of my favorite actors of all time. So that boosts it up, you know, but I get where you're coming from too, because he's really good at doing straight horror. You know, the Prince of Darkness is also, I think, a little bit underrated, even despite a nice special edition from Scream Factory. I still feel like people don't totally appreciate that movie because it's not like sort of a raucous, not to say his films are a raucous good time, because The Thing I don't think is a raucous good time, but there's something about those Kurt Russell movies that people really dig, and I think the same people don't necessarily always love Prince of Darkness for some reason.
Yeah, Kurt Russell is definitely so charismatic and just seems like somebody you could have a beer with. I feel like it's very easy to get on his side. Prince of Darkness is a little strange because it almost doesn't have a main character.
Mm-mm.
It's just kind of, you're watching this happen to a group of people.
Supposing it isn't a dream. Supposing it's a message.
What if these dreams, premonitions, omens, what if they're really visual messages sent by other human beings? Photographs, video signals.
From where?
The future. Anything traveling faster than the speed of light would appear to be going backward in time.
A future scientist calculates the exact spot that the Earth occupied in space in the past, given trajectory and speed. He then beams a tachyon signal at that spot, transmitting video information backwards through time.
For us to receive as electrical impulses, neural stimulus.
For what purpose?
Could be a warning to show us what's going to happen. A sort of remote camera view of the future so that we can change it.
So I guess there's not that one person that you can really side with. It's also different because, which is something I think is cool about it, but I know it's a weird concept of how like science could create the devil. It's kind of the only time, I actually can't think of any other movie that does that, where it's actually science conjuring up the coming of Satan.
Yeah.
By injecting it's like a liquid that is possessed with the spirit that shoots itself into somebody's mouth that creates like the son of Satan, who then opens a portal to pull Satan into our world. But because it's Carpenter, it's really scary.
Yeah.
And It's just very unsettling. It feels like something that takes its time getting under your skin, and it's just slowly unnerving.
Totally.
Until it all starts to fall apart. And I just think that it has like one of the best endings, not only like the final shot, which is very Inception up in the air, but before that, the big finale when they're about to pull Satan through the mirror. That image of that girl being stuck in the other dimension, I think, is one of the most haunting images Carpenter has ever shown.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, there's a ton of great images in that movie, and I think it's easily his most sort of heady, you know, story, that it's touching on religious and philosophical points, and yeah, it's really reaching, you know, it's theorizing, it's just, there's a lot going on there, a lot to chew on, and I think that's another reason some people don't always want to go there. They just want, you know, a straight ahead sort of horror story. And there's just more to it than that. But that is also another reason why I like it. You know, it's really thought provoking. Like every time I watch it, because I'm not a particularly religious person anymore. I mean, I was raised that way, but it is something that makes me think about things in a way. And that's another thing you don't, I mean, horror has that ability to make you think about things. Again, smuggling sort of thematics, and a lot of times religion is a part of horror, but that movie in particular, I find, you know, really thought provoking, and there's definitely something to it. I think it's really cool that it's one of your favorites. Like, that's definitely one that I want everybody to give sort of a reevaluation to, and I don't know if it's ever going to happen fully, but regardless, it's amazing.
It would be nice. Just go back and rewatch it and be amused by the fact that Satan seeps in through computers.
Well, yeah, I would say, you know, as mentioned at the top of the episode, watch the entire Apocalypse trilogy. You know, everybody loves The Thing, rightfully so, because it's amazing. But watch The Thing, then watch Prince of Darkness, and then watch In the Mouth of Madness. And I think that sort of gives like a really unique sort of, again, philosophical experience, you know, as well as a great triple feature of horror films, you know.
For sure. And it's interesting to see it kind of progress where like The Thing starts way far away, feels like something that's nowhere near us because it's happening in the Arctic, but will slowly eventually take over the world. And then there's Prince of Darkness, which is very contained inside of a church, which also has the possibility of expanding. But then when it finally gets to In the Mouth of Madness, it feels like just a total global takeover.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It does feel like a totally apocalyptic, like everything is fucked. And I do like that progression. And the idea of like infection is running through like all three of those movies. Like, and that is definitely something I think is a true and real terror that people can totally tap into, you know.
Yeah.
We've all gotten sick from one thing or another, and the idea that, you know, whatever evil spreading that way is it's really relatable, and I think it totally freaks people the fuck out.
That's a great point. It's each one of them is like a plague in its own way.
Three plagues, absolutely. Yeah, no, great, all great movies, but definitely a good a triple feature that I have yet to do myself, but I want to do, because especially after rewatching this one, there's just a great trio of films, you know, not surprisingly from a great filmmaker. But anyway, I think that is it for this episode. Kaylin, thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. I've been trying to do this more on the show. Where can people find you online if they wanted to do so?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Kaylin Corrigan. I am also on Instagram, and you can find my work on Birth, Movies, Death, Bloody Disgusting, JoeBlow.com, Collider.com, and a few others.
Excellent, excellent. Well, everyone have a lovely and Blu-ray-filled week, and I will talk to you very soon. Bye-bye.